This is The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker, speaking to you from my home in Woods Hole. It's Friday, January 22nd, and this is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Jeanette Barnes, Noah Asimow at the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll speak with Casey Myers from the Provincetown Independent, Ethan Genter from the Cape Cod Times, George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times, and we'll hear from CAI's Mike Dean at the State House and CAI's environmental reporter Eve Zuckoff. And now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. National news played big this week with the inauguration of President Biden and Vice President Harris. CAI's Jeanette Barnes joins us with the local angle on this story and more. Hi, Jeanette.
Great to be here, Steve.
Jeanette, Tuesday, all eyes were on Washington, D.C. for the swearing-in ceremony. For Democrats around the region, it was a moment to celebrate. You caught up with the celebration on the South Coast. Tell us where this was and what you heard from people.
It was in New Bedford, but not downtown. It was near the Dartmouth line at a very visible intersection there at Route 6 and 140. And when I was there, there were 15 people. So kind of a modest turnout, but they had music playing from a speaker. They were holding signs and waving American flags, dancing around a little bit. People said they feel a sense of hope for our country, that it will now be more the country that it ought to be. They talked about healing. One man actually said he feels like a war has ended. They were getting plenty of honks from drivers who were going by, and also because it's at the edge of Buttonwood Park there in the city, there were quite a few joggers coming by around the corner and kind of cheering and putting their hands in the air. So relatively small group, but it was a mood of celebration for sure.
Any pushback from passersby?
I believe one accompanied his honk with a certain hand gesture, but otherwise I didn't hear any other any sort of shouting or things like that.
Let's talk about the coronavirus a moment. This week, the nation passed 400,000 deaths from the virus. Locally, we continue to see high hospitalization rates. In the last week or so, a recovery unit has opened on the Cape. Tell us what we know about this facility.
Yes, I just confirmed it's Thursday. So it's the Pleasant Bay Nursing Home in Brewster. The administrator there says they opened an isolated unit, recovery unit for COVID-19 on January 14th. It has 8 beds and 4 patients right now. He says this unit was opened specifically to admit people coming out of hospitals who no longer need hospital-level care. And Cape Cod Healthcare has not been able to reopen the step-down unit that it had last spring. So this one, while it's not big, is notable and hopefully will be enough to fill the need.
We've talked in the past about how the delegation had been looking, the Cape delegation had been appealing to the governor to support the opening of a step-down facility or recovery facility. So this seems like a step in the right direction, and New Bedford already has one, right?
Yes, they do. This was a little tricky, I think, for the Cape because they had this kind of standalone unit, and the state decided this time it was not going to fund that standalone unit at the same in the same way that it did in the spring, and it was going to look to fund isolation units within existing facilities. So now this one on the Cape is an isolation unit in an existing facility.
Jeanette, meanwhile, the rollout continues in Massachusetts. What's the latest here?
This week and into next week, the focus is still on congregate care settings like shelters, jails, and group homes. Fred Chirigotis, who is the CEO of Chips House in Centerville, talked to reporters about this yesterday. They are going to be getting the vaccine. Chips House, if folks don't know, is community housing for people who are disabled by head injury, and it's in Centerville. So the CEO there, he says he certainly welcomes the vaccine. Many of the residents are wheelchair bound, and so they're pretty vulnerable to illness. He says even a typical flu season there can be pretty bad. And they are scheduled to start getting the vaccine Wednesday. following that, yeah, we go on to phase, the next step of phase, the tail end, rather, of phase one.
Well, tell us, local officials are starting
Yeah.
to look ahead to this now, and they're thinking about how they're going to manage the next phase of the rollout. Tell us what you've heard.
Yeah, so they're thinking about how to get people registered for appointments once larger and larger groups of people become eligible for the vaccine. You still cannot pre-register, but they're looking ahead to that. So what Barnstable County is doing, the health director, Sean O'Brien, said that sometime in phase two, the county will probably open up the same online platform that they use to register first responders for their vaccine. So that other, you know, the larger and larger groups, they could then access the same platform. Also, for people who have any kind of issue or barrier with internet access, they are planning to take appointments by phone, possibly using the county's COVID-19 hotline that they recently opened. But again, we want to emphasize that right now they haven't started doing that, so you can't make an appointment today on that hotline, but they're thinking about using that eventually, and they said they'll make it, you know, they'll make a wide announcement when that happens so people will know. Sure, I was just going to mention, so heading into the next few weeks is the wrap-up of phase one, and the final two groups in phase one are home healthcare workers and other healthcare workers who don't handle COVID patients. Local officials have told us that it's likely those groups will be getting the vaccine through their employers, but they really don't have official word from the state on that yet.
I want to ask you about one other story that you reported this week. The Buttonwood Park Zoo in New Bedford is looking for a male lynx. And in case you have one out there, it's not just any male lynx they're looking for. Tell us about this.
Yeah. Yes. So it's a Canada lynx, first of all, that they're looking for. There are a few different types of lynx around the world. And what they're looking for is one that's part of the species survival plan of the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. And the idea is not just survival, but maximizing the genetic diversity of those zoos, the zoo lynxes in North America. So hint, hint there, they're looking for one of breeding age, and they're hoping for kittens eventually with their female lynx, which is named Sylvie. So, yeah, they are looking for it to arrive in the springtime.
Some pretty cute lynx pictures on our website there, capeandislands.org. CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
Some ownership and operations changes are potentially coming to Martha's Vineyard waterfronts. Noah Asimo of the Vineyard Gazette has details for us and joins us now. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Steve.
Noah, let's start in Menemsha, where the Menemsha Fish House shut down as a business in big part because of the pressures of the pandemic. Now it looks like it may reopen under new management. Is that fair to say?
Sort of. So essentially what happened was the Menemsha Fish House, which was the only seafood wholesaler in Menemsha, which is a historic waterfront port, closed just due to the pandemic. There were a lot of constraints on the seafood wholesaling industry, restaurants being a non-operational, one of the largest ones. And so in sort of a, you know, one door closing, another opening situation, the Martha's Vineyard Fishermen's Preservation Trust, which is a nonprofit dedicated to preserving working waterfronts, among other stuff, they sort of have stepped in, and it's their goal to open up a seafood wholesaler in the same location as the fish house, pretty much modeled after the fish house and even using some of the same employees of the fish house. But it would be slightly different in that the Menemsha Fish House was actually owned by Red's Best, which is a Boston-based seafood wholesaler, so it was just one of their locations. This would be an island-based seafood wholesaler, and it would be run by the nonprofit, which would be sort of a change of tack for them, but is, you know, essentially in their mission, which is, you know, having and preserving working waterfront and helping local fishermen. So sort of the same thing, but actually it would be under different management and whatnot.
It sounds like a hopeful step, though. Just briefly, where is that in the process?
Yeah, so actually two big steps forward were made this week. The Fisherman's Preservation Trust was able to sign a lease with the town for the building. The town owns all those buildings on the Dutcher Dock in Menemsha, and then they have deed restrictions and covenants that, you know, make them have to be for working waterfront purposes. They were looking for a tenant. The trust has stepped into that. And then also at the same time and sort of in tandem with that, the trust has launched a capital campaign. So they're looking to raise $500,000 by February. It's totally an urgent campaign in order to basically raise enough money to get the startup costs covered that they're going to need to be able to buy equipment, staff the building, and be ready and operational by April, which is sort of the heat of the fishing season. And it sounds like I was talking to their executive director, Dr. Shelley Edmondson, yesterday, and she said that they've raised $286,000 of the $500,000, and they have a donor who's matching any donation between $25,000 and $2,500. So they're still looking for money, but they're confident that they're going to be able to make it a reality. And it's something that they're saying would be really beneficial for the fishermen in Menemsha. You know, they expect about 100 local fishermen would be using the fish, or would be using, they're calling it the Martha's Vineyard Seafood Collaborative, Sustainable Seafood Collaborative. Mm-hmm. And so sort of would have widespread benefit for fishermen who have been struggling due to the pandemic.
Hey, we have just about a minute and a half here, but I want to ask you about what seems like it could be another big story. You have a story about a national company, a big national company, looking at a purchase of more than one marina on the island. What's the latest here?
Yeah, so Prime Marina, which has locations in Vineyard Haven and Edgartown, they're currently in negotiations to sell their business operations to a Dallas-based company called Safe Harbor Marinas. Safe Harbor Marinas is one of the largest, if not the largest, marina operator in the world. They currently have marinas pretty much dotted all over the United States. But the reason that this is sort of a tangled transaction that needs to happen, because Prime Marina, while they own the land outright in Vineyard Haven, actually leased property through these tangled easements with the town in Edgartown. So talking to town officials, they said that the negotiations are underway, and basically they need to sign a certificate in order to transfer the leases. And so the sale hasn't officially gone through, and we'll see what happens. But it would be a change for the harborfront in both towns, and Prime Marina is the largest sort of full-service marine operation on the island. You know, they're not really anywhere in comparison to Safe Harbor Marinas in terms of size on a national level. But, yeah, it's an interesting development that's going on.
That is Noah Asimo from the Vineyard Gazette. Noah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. A sweet smell may soon be wafting from a former fitness facility and newspaper printing plant in Orleans. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle is here with that story and more. Hi, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, a new tenant is eyeing this property in Orleans. This is a nice story. Tell us who this is and what they want to do with the property.
Sure. The company is Chiquesset Chocolate. Right now, they run a workshop, cafe, and a gift shop in North Truro. And they make what they call Cape Cod craft chocolate, sort of a high-end chocolate with a Cape Cod theme, and they are proposing to expand into the 7,400 square foot former Cape Codder newspaper printery on Namskaket Road in Orleans. Right now, as you said, there was a fitness center that moved in there when the printery closed down a number of years ago, but the fitness center has since closed and the space is vacant right now. And the proposal calls for expanding Chiquesset Chocolate's retail and candy manufacturing facility, as well as an order fulfillment center into the space. And they'll also plan on opening a second cafe there as well. The owners say that this new facility will allow them to produce more of their chocolate, higher quality and a lower cost. I mean, who can argue with any of that? And to keep up with the growing demand that this company has had. At this point, they met this week with the site plan review committee, and they're going to be going to the Zoning Board of Appeals for a change of use special permit. If that is approved, they say that their plan will be to close on the property in the spring and open their new facility early in 2022.
There's good news for folks there in Orleans and that part of the Cape to have a chocolatier coming to them that way. I want to ask you about...
I was going to say it's right down the street from the center of town, right off of Main Street. So it's it'd be a nice sort of walking destination for people to have a cafe and a place where they can go, and you can actually watch them make the chocolate here. So it's a pretty good attraction.
You have another story this week about a historic name change in Chatham Town Government. Tell us about this.
Sure. Last week, Chatham joined seven other Cape towns, more than 100 in the state, actually, in designating its chief elected body as the Select Board, leaving behind more than 300-year tradition of having the Board of Selectmen lead the town. The effort to make this name change began back in 2019 when former Selectman Florence Selden, former Select Board member Florence Selden, and resident Debbie Aikman presented a non-binding citizens petition to town meeting calling for the change, and that was overwhelmingly endorsed by voters. And they were reacting to a 2019 vote by January 2019 vote by the Board of Selectmen at the time, who rejected the idea and wanted to hold on to the old tradition. But a few months later, after the vote from town meeting, the Board of Selectmen changed their minds and voted this past August to endorse the name change in recognition of the 100th anniversary of women gaining the right to vote, the 19th Amendment, and the board. Voted to submit special legislation for the title change to the legislature. They had to do that because the town's homeroom charter refers to the policymaking board as the Board of Selectmen, so that change needed to be made sort of formally. And last week, January 13th, Governor Baker signed that legislation, and the board formally became the Select Board, and Chair Shireen Davis welcomed the change and said she felt all along that gender should be a personal issue and not an institutional one. And Florence Selden, who was behind this, said she was very glad to see the change, and she has several granddaughters, and she hopes that this sort of move will help encourage more women to run for office in Chatham and elsewhere, and also to participate in town government.
It's a change we've been seeing across the region, across the state, I guess, really.
Yeah, as I said, about 100 towns in the state have made that change, towns that have boards of selectmen. And I think it's just in recognition of the more awareness of gender issues and the use of gender inflected words in the meaning that actually comes with those these days. It's just has much more resonance, I think.
It's Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Steve.
A housing development with more than three dozen units of affordable rental housing moved one step closer to becoming a reality in Truro this week. Casey Myers of the Provincetown Independent has this story, joins us now. Hi, Casey.
Hello. How are you, Steve?
I'm doing well. I want to ask you about this. This is the Cloverleaf Project, and it has been controversial. It has opposition in the town. Tell us about the latest approval that it's gotten here.
Okay. Well, after more than a year of, a lot of controversy and a lot of outcomes due to the controversy, which I'll talk about if we have time, but they did, the Zoning Board of Appeals did approve the comprehensive permit to give this affordable housing the green light. And that is now subject, of course, to a possible appeal by the neighbors who have really been active. They've organized themselves. They've hired an attorney. And the attorney I spoke to last week, he said they have not decided whether or not they are going to appeal. They have 20 days from when the town actually does file their approval, which I'm not sure if they actually have filed it yet. But anyway, then they have 20 days to appeal. So it's unknown. It's also a few other things are unknown too. I didn't know about this until I really dived into this long process. But the Pond Village neighbors are not exactly direct abutters, so they don't automatically have standing, which is a legal term to say you have an automatic right to appeal. So unless a direct abutter within 300 feet of this development appeals, then it would be another step in the court process where the Pond Village neighbors, who are farther away, would have to argue that they should have standing because they would be negatively affected by this development.
Well, in a shorthand here, tell us what the controversy or what a lot of the pushback, the opposition centers around for this.
Sure. Well, the opposition really centers around the water quality. Pond Village is a very low-lying valley surrounded by hills, surrounded by Route 6 is nearby. And it gets all the storm runoff, all the fertilizer runoff, everything. It's also a historic village, so the lots are very small and wells and septic systems close together. And there's 5 cesspools also in that neighborhood. So for all those reasons, the water quality at Pond Village isn't good. Many wells are high in nitrates. And the Cloverleaf, which is about, a little less than a mile away, the opponents argue, will hurt their water quality because it is a very intense use, especially for Truro. It's not really an intense use for a city or even in Provincetown, but it is an intense use for the town of Truro, relatively speaking. So the opponents are arguing that the water quality will be harmed by this this apartment complex or series of apartment complexes. And so that's what they've been arguing, and they did make a lot of progress. I mean, their pushback has meant that there's a special treatment system that's going to treat the effluent all the way down to 5 milligrams per liter, which is extremely low because the average septic system only reduces nitrogen once it goes through the leaching pit to 25 milligrams per liter. And everyone seems just fine with their neighbor septic systems releasing that high nitrate, but they're not so fine with 5 milligrams per liter, which is a little bit of you got to really wonder then what's their actual logic, if they're really thinking it through, or if this is just a fear of change or a fear of the intensity of the. Just it's just very different for Truro, I think is a lot of what's going on here.
There's a lot of. Just in terms of numbers, they're talking about, 39 units in this development?
Yep, 39 units. And, it would be the largest affordable housing in Truro. But Truro is a small, extremely rural town with zoning that kind of just does not encourage affordable housing at all. The zoning laws are, like most of Cape Cod, very favorable towards, McMansions, really. So... a couple of things, if we have time, Steve, that came out of over a year-long debate about this, which got ugly. I mean, I was really surprised how ugly this got. But a couple of things that came out of it were Pond Village might actually get public water because North Truro already has a public water line running through it. It just doesn't happen to go down to that neighborhood. But now the town has put on the town meeting warrant a study to pay for the cost of a study to possibly bring town water to that area. And then they also are working on a regulation that's going to be subject to a public hearing that would ban cesspools by 2023. Every town still has cesspools, and they're really bad for the environment, and they're allowed to exist because people just keep inheriting homes, and they never are subject to the triggering requirements to upgrade. So a couple of good things seem to have really come out of it, potentially.
Casey Myers of the Provincetown Independent. Casey, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you. Have a great day.
The trial of the man accused in the killing of Yarmouth Police Sergeant Sean Gannon is set for this summer. Ethan Genter of the Cape Cod Times joins us with this story and more. Hi, Ethan.
Good morning, Mr. Junker.
Ethan, the last time we talked about this, lawyers for the defendant here were trying to get the trial moved. Bring us up to date with what's happened.
Yeah, so the attorneys for Thomas Lutano accused of killing Yarmouth Police Sergeant Sean Gannon, they were arguing that there was so much attention and the kind of community sentiment around Mr. Lutanovich was just so negative that there was no way they could get an impartial jury to sit for this trial. So he was arguing, the attorney was arguing to get it moved off Cape, even out of even neighboring counties. I think he suggested things like Springfield to try and get a better chance at a fair trial. Last week, Barnstable Superior Judge ruled that just because there's extensive coverage, media coverage of something that happened, a case does not automatically grant you the right to get it out of the municipality or the county that it happened in. It also has to be very kind of sensational and inflammatory coverage. And she looked at thousands of documents that were subpoenaed. Most of it was from our publication, and kind of said it doesn't really meet that inflammatory standard. It's a pretty high bar to clear to get it moved for this presumption of prejudice is kind of the reasoning.
It's scheduled now to happen this summer.
Yes. Yeah. They set that a little earlier in the winter. Whether that happens is always tough. Winter trial or summer trials are always hard on Cape Cod by people's schedules, either working or people aren't around on vacation. And obviously there's COVID. We still have to factor into kind of there's not a whole lot of trials going on right now. So that is set for August 2nd. Whether that actually happens remains to be seen.
I want to ask you about another story you covered this week. For years now, you've been covering proposals to replace the Cape Bridges, the Bourne Bridge and the Sagamore Bridge. In an incremental way, this immense project seems to be inching forward. A couple of things happened in the last week or so. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so the first thing, last Friday, the Governor Charlie Baker signed a $16 billion transportation bond bill. A lot of things ended up getting cut out of what was in that bill when it got to him, but one thing that did make it through was $350 million in bond authorizations for kind of the roads around the bridges, which is what's owned by the state. The bridges are federally owned. So this has been something that the state has been pushing. You can't just replace the bridges and just leave the same infrastructure around them. So they've been trying to get the roads changed for a while now. I mean, some of the changes they've proposed is kind of adding an extra eastbound lane on 6, kind of once you go over the bridge on the Sagamore, kind of reconstructing the Bourne Rotary into an interchange, changing the Belmont Circle, moving 1C back, what was formerly known as 1C, and kind of adding a ramp to get you straight onto 25 from the scenic highway, skipping kind of the rotary there. But yeah, so a lot of the people I talked to kind of said this kind of signals to the federal government, which would be responsible for replacing these bridges, that we're ready to go, ready when you are. We're ready to borrow the money to pay for these projects.
The federal government being a big part of this, yesterday we heard the Cape Bridges elevated into the national discussion.
Yeah, absolutely. So during his confirmation hearing with a Senate committee, Pete Buttigieg, who's up for to run the transportation department, was invited by Ed Markey, one of our senators, to come tour the bridges. What a tour of the bridges would exactly include, I don't know. if a walk on one of the sidewalks is a little scary. I've done it quite a few times. And Mayor Pete has been down to the Cape before. I'm not sure if he came over the bridge. He went to Provincetown during his presidential bid, so he could conceivably have flown into the airport there. So, maybe we'll see the head of the Department of Transportation come down. I talked to a few people who said that was at least exciting to get into the national conversation. We'll see if this kind of helps chug things along here.
Mr. Ethan Genter from the Cape Cod Times, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker, broadcasting from my home office. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on the Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. The Cape and Islands have a nitrogen problem. It comes from wastewater from septic systems leaching into the local environment. George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times has the story of one island resident who's promoting a new solution. Hi, George.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
George, seems like there's more than a little serendipity in this story. It's about a person being in the right place with what seems like a good idea at a moment he didn't even expect to be building a new business. Tell us about John Smith.
Yeah, so John Smith is a 40-year career engineer, and he was looking to spend a little bit more time at his at a home he owns in Edgartown and, just settle in a little bit. But soon after spending more time on the island, he started to pay more attention to the real issue both on the Cape and the islands, which is this nitrogen loading in ponds, and particularly critical on the island where these ponds are so important to the shellfish industry. And so he started looking into what could be done other than sewers, which are incredibly expensive, as everyone knows. And he developed a system, he calls it Nitro, and it removes much of the nitrogen from septic tanks. And the interesting thing about this, Steve, is that the existing Title V systems can be retrofitted with Nitro. So you don't have to put in an entirely new system. You can add on Nitro to an existing one. About 3 years ago, he teamed up with Tisbury to install about 10 of these systems to get some data. The data looks good on those. And so he's moved steps closer to getting certification to start installing these in other places, which is pretty exciting news. It comes at a price, of course. It about doubles the cost of a septic system for a home. But in the long run, potentially a small price to pay compared to hooking up to a sewer system, building a sewer system, which, there are some existing on the island, but to add on to them, millions and millions of dollars. So a potential solution here for a very serious problem, both on the Cape and the islands.
And this week, you also have a dispatch from Ireland in the paper. It draws a connection from Ireland to Martha's Vineyard to President Biden. Tell us about this.
Yeah, this was written by Elaine Weintraub, and she's been an educator on Martha's Vineyard for years, and she is in Ireland, was in Ireland this week, for where she is an immigrant from. And she was there in a small town called Ballina. It's where she's from. And it's also where Joe Biden's family originally came from when they came to the United States. And so they have adopted Joe Biden. He's been there a couple of times, both as vice president and a private citizen, and they're just in love with our new president, potentially more than the United States, where we have sort of a divided country at the moment between people who support Biden and those who supported the former president, Trump. It's pretty much universal in the small town of Ballina in the county of Mayo in Ireland that Joe Biden's their guy.
And listen, I just want to quickly point to an essay. You have a fun essay on the smells of the island. These aren't the generic seaside smells we all think of. It's deeper than that. This is by Jeff Currier. Just briefly, tell us about this.
Yeah, so Jeff Currier had heard that there were bath salts that had the smell of Nantucket. So that got him to thinking, well, what's the smell of Martha's Vineyard? And we'll leave it to you to read and see what he came up with for the smell of Martha's Vineyard.
Very good. George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
There's been some talk in Massachusetts about the future of the Republican Party here. Now that President Trump is out of office, Governor Baker's the state's top Republican, obviously. He consistently gets high ratings from voters on both sides of the aisle. He was publicly critical of the outgoing president, but the state's Republican Party chair is a Trump supporter. CAI's Catherine Ident talked with our State House reporter Mike Dean about the new landscape for the state's GOP and other news from Beacon Hill. Here's their conversation.
Good morning, Mike.
Hey, good morning, Catherine.
What are you hearing now in the days after the transition of power about Governor Charlie Baker and his impact on the Massachusetts Republican Party now that Trump is indeed out of office?
Yeah, I mean, you could say that Baker is really as secure as ever here in Massachusetts. You know, his approval ratings are still sky high. People think that he's handling the coronavirus fairly well, generally speaking. There's been criticism, of course, of the vaccination plan as that gets going. But in general, voters consistently like keeping the conservative governor as opposed to the more liberal-leaning Democratic legislature. So, you know, if he wants it, a third term is within his grasp, at least, you know, a run for such a thing, given his popularity. But, you know, the question is really more about what happens now with his style of Republicanism. Is that limited just to Massachusetts? Can this kind of, you know, Republican only exist in a Democratic state? That's kind of where Baker finds himself while Republicans are now searching for some kind of post-Trump philosophy.
Talk for a minute about Governor Charlie Baker's political philosophy and how it does kind of jive or not jive with the National Party at this point.
It's tough to nail down exactly what Baker's philosophy is, but from observing him over the years, I would just describe it, if it's got to be one word, as cooperative. You know, it's by necessity. Governor Baker doesn't have much choice since he's usually the only Republican in the room with, you know, a bunch of kind of leading Democrats, whether it's our congressional delegation or the House and Senate leadership, or really just some of the institutions around Massachusetts. It's pretty blue all around him. There's purple here and there, certainly, but there's not that many other Republicans. So he has to cooperate. But the thing is about Baker, that is how he thinks it should work. If you ask him, as I did last week, you know, what do you think your brand is and can you export it? He said that, you know, Republicans need to remember that they had a point of view about the importance of economic development, the importance of fiscal responsibility, being disciplined with spending, the importance of community building, he mentioned. And he kind of summarized it by saying it doesn't matter if you're Republican or Democrat or independent or whatever, but that it's a team sport. And that if you can't come at it as a team sport, you know, the give and the take of governing, then you're going to have a hard time being successful. He doesn't mean successful politically. He means successful in actually governing.
So that said, does Baker have his eye on the national stage? Or, you know, you said a little earlier that Baker could be running for a third term, and he certainly is popular enough here in Massachusetts. So do you have any idea on where he might be leaning?
Yeah, when you ask him, as I did, about if he wants to, as I say, export that kind of Republicanism to the National Party in the post-Trump era, he says that he's open to it. He says he'll have those conversations and he'll do whatever he can to kind of help out, so to speak. But he was firm in saying it's only going to come as governor of Massachusetts. He's not going to use the governorship as a stepping stone to a federal office or anything like that. But, you know, that leads to the question, do you run for a third term, become a veteran three-term governor who can be pretty influential on the party nationally? And so, yeah, he definitely still has his eyes on a third term, at least that's what we're hearing around here. If you look at his fundraising, though, it is kind of a different story. He doesn't have nearly nearly as much in his war chest as he usually does, you know, if he were gearing up to run in 2022, which is the next gubernatorial election. His running mate, Karen Pulido, the lieutenant governor, actually has more than twice the amount of money in her war chest. Now, that doesn't mean that Baker can't turn on the tap for fundraising, you know, and catch up there. And it doesn't mean that Pulido's going to challenge Baker for anything like that. They're still pretty much seen as a unit and a ticket. But it means that she is prepared to go her own way, at least financially prepared, to do it if Baker declines a third term.
In the meantime, though, Baker does have a job and he is active. In fact, he has been active with his veto pen. He had some issues with some items inside a transportation bond bill. Mike, aren't these bills rather boilerplate usually? What did he take issue with?
Well, what happened on Beacon Hill is what was supposed to be a pretty routine transportation bond bill grew over the 2 years it was being negotiated and worked on. It's not just that kind of bond borrowing authorization that we typically think of. I know we all think of bond bills all the time, like I do. But, you know, a lot of policy changes got packed into this bill because other transportation bills didn't really go anywhere. So this thing actually ended up with, you know, a commission on studying congestion pricing, meaning, you know, certain highways could be more expensive at certain times. That's something that people have been looking at to solve our congestion problem for a while. There was a requirement that, you know, proceeds from this new carbon cap tax that's what we're going to get involved with would be deposited to the transportation fund for the state instead of the general fund and used for other areas. You know, and there was something, you know, the Cape can look at. The regional transit authorities, you know, the CCRTA and their 14 other authorities across the state, they would have been able to study means-tested fares, meaning essentially poorer people could pay less for taking the bus system. All of that was kind of rejected by Baker. So Baker signed the borrowing portions and sent back these policy questions. Basically, Baker zoomed out and said, the coronavirus pandemic has changed so much of our transportation lifestyle and transportation patterns that now is not the time to take on these big changes. You know, if why take on, you know, different parts of congestion pricing, for instance, when we don't really have any congestion at the moment? That's going to change. The traffic's going to come back. I hate to tell you, you know, that's all going to come back. But Baker wants to slow down those Democratic proposals.
And finally, we just have a few seconds left. We know Baker vetoed a massive climate change bill, and we've talked about that. House Speaker Ron Mariano said he would refile it. Is there a timeline now for a new vote on this bill?
Oh, yeah, there's all the time in the world since it's the beginning of the session. So instead of at the last minute crunch like before, they're going to refile exactly what they passed and override Baker's veto. No changes at all to the bill. This is the only such bill that they're going to do that to. So they're going to override him this time on this particular thing. But really don't expect Democrats to challenge Baker's other vetoes that he made during that crunch time of the end of the last session.
And that is CAI State House reporter Mike Dean talking with us live from Beacon Hill. Mike, thanks a lot. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
And that is CAI's Catherine Iden speaking there with Mike Dean. You're listening to the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. The Cape Cod Commission unanimously amended a policy plan that guides the region's priorities this week to include climate mitigation goals. CAI's Eve Zuckoff reports the change was prompted by a group of citizens, and she joins us now to talk about what happened. Hi, Eve.
Hi there, Steve.
Eve, let's start with this plan. What kinds of amendments have been added to it?
Yeah, so the commissioners approved amendments, again, to the 2018 regional policy plan that fall under four major categories. So clean energy, carbon sequestration, and greener alternatives in the building and transportation sectors. So those goals will mean the commission encourages electric vehicle adoption, battery storage with renewable energy generation, work from home policies, and electric heat pumps in homes and commercial buildings. And a whole host of other goals to reduce greenhouse gas emissions coming from this region.
So for those following along on this, it seems pretty major that the commission amended one of its own policies. How did that come about?
Yeah, so this is years in the making. Climate activists prompted the commission to amend the policy plan by filing a citizen's petition that offered 10 of their own amendments. because they said the plan just didn't do enough to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But during actually a pretty heated meeting in July, commission members said, okay, we're going to table petitioners' amendments, but we're also going to direct staff to develop climate mitigation amendments in-house over a six-month period. And that's what brings us to today. So now these new amendments will be sent to Barnstable County Assembly of Delegates for final approval.
Also this week, Eve, we heard about some other environmentalists who are opposing a proposal for a machine gun range that the Massachusetts Army National Guard wants to build the Joint Base Cape Cod. This, too, is an ongoing story. What's the latest here?
Yeah, so the Association to Preserve Cape Cod filed a public records request with the Massachusetts National Guard Bureau on Tuesday because they're requesting the release of all public comments that have been submitted in response to the $11 million machine gun range proposal. Guard officials have said, you know, they're in the process of responding to 900 individual comments submitted this past summer. Including those challenging the project's environmental assessment, which found the range will have no significant impact on groundwater, wildlife, or other natural features. But none of those comments are public. And environmentalists, particularly with APCC, feel like those 900 comments are going to many of them are going to show an outpouring of public opposition to the range, which should be public and should matter when, you know, the state decides whether or not to approve this range going forward. But it's worth noting that CAI has reached out to the Guard and we haven't heard back.
Before we go here, I want to ask you about the latest on endangered North Atlantic right whales. Yesterday, federal officials released a report evaluating their own efforts to reduce the number of right whale deaths. Tell us about this report. What was in it?
Yeah, so this report looked at regulations issued in 2008 to reduce the number of right whales dying in collisions with boats and ships. And basically, it found that boats are ignoring voluntary and, in some cases, mandatory speed limits. Locally, the assessment found ships ignoring a voluntary speed zone in an area south of Nantucket. And they're being ignored so much so that in the decade before the regulations, 8 whales died from vessel strikes. And in the decade after, 12 whales died from vessel strikes. So NOAA says, this is a quote, "This overall decline demonstrates progress, but also indicates additional action is warranted to further reduce the threat of vessel collisions." So to conservationists, this reads as an admission that NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, has dropped the ball as right whales population has plummeted. And it also comes just a week after one conservation group from Boston, the Conservation Law Foundation, filed litigation to protect right whales from vessel strikes. And NOAA is looking at this and saying, we've made this evaluation. We now are recommending increased enforcement of speed limits, expansion of mandatory no-speed zones, and a rethinking of areas that have only had voluntary speed restrictions up until this point.
We've got about 30 seconds here. End us on a more positive note about the population of right whales.
Yeah, so there's been a bit of good news this week. We saw the 13th calf of the season born spotted off the coast of Georgia, and that 13 is such a good number. For context, only 22 calves were born in the 3 years prior. So that is something that conservationists are feeling really hopeful about.
That is CAI's environmental reporter, Eve Zuckoff. Eve, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
And that is our show for today. I want to thank my guests. We heard from CAI's Jeanette Barnes and Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette. We spoke with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Independent. We heard from Ethan Genter at the Cape Cod Times, George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, CAI's Mike Dean at the State House, and, of course, CAI's Eve Zuckoff there. Thanks to Dan Treidle back at the studio, just making the whole program work smoothly. From my home in Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.